Hello, and welcome to Barks Remarks, the podcast where we talk about the stories from the legendary Carl Barks, creator of Scrooge McDuck and writer and artist of the greatest Donald and Scrooge comics of all time. Join us as we explore his longer adventure stories in their chronological publishing order. We'll talk about what makes them so enduring, their historical context, and how well they hold up today. So get out your reprint and get ready to enjoy our remarks. Welcome back to Barks Remarks. I'm Mark Severino, a grown man who enjoys Duck comics, and I am joined by two other very rugged grown men. I'm going to introduce them and then ask them to just maybe talk about when they first read our story that we're going to be covering today, which is the all-time great, The Golden Helmet. So first, I've got Warren Harmon. Warren, tell us, when did you read this?
Hey, Mark. Good to be back. I read this probably about 40 years ago when I landed into the one of the many reprints. It was kind of an upstate when I was in my 20s, and I was just starting to really avidly consider collecting Carl Barks stuff. It really stuck out for me. But I reread it, and the story today is a lot more meaning than it did 40 years ago. I will tell you that.
So, nice. Yeah. And we're likewise joined by Austin Kelly. Austin, when did you read this one?
First, of course, it's great to be back for, I think, the third time, which is pretty cool. Yeah, embarrassingly, it was, I think it was back in January, was my first read through. You know, when I first discovered Disney Comics, there was so much. That's the great thing. There's so much dense material, and it's all just of such high quality. There's so much Barks, Rosa, Italian stuff. So I had to just go through whatever I could whenever I could get it. And Golden Helmet was just at the back of the line for no particular reason. But I got to it, and I'm just, I mean, it blew my mind because I think it's a great story.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any reason to be embarrassed, right? Yeah, you've got to read it for the first time sometime, and it's a real treat. I'm assuming that everyone on this call feels largely the same about this one, probably the way that most of the Duck community does. This is an all-time classic. This is one of the most famous Barks stories. I don't know about you guys, but I am just so excited to talk about this one.
Yeah, to have all three of us talk about this classic and to really dig deep into the story structure, to the artwork. But yeah, this is going to be great.
Yeah. And we were joking around a moment ago that we've got kind of like Gold Key era reader. And I'd be like a Gladstone era reader. And Austin, what would you be like, Gemstone or Fantagraphics?
Yeah, kind of more Fantagraphics, but Gemstone also.
Sure. So like, this is an evergreen story. It holds up. It is a must read for a comic book fan. This is a great one to if you want to introduce someone to Carl Barks. I didn't mention myself. I first read this when I'm thinking I must have been 8 or 9. It was in Gladstone's big album, which, you know, those album covers, those giant oversized ones, they all stood out so vividly. And seeing that great famous cover, Donald holding the helmet aloft, it's so enticing. And I was just so excited to read it. And I know I went back to this one over and over. Yeah. It almost felt pointless to reread it again, but I had such a good time revisiting it this week.
It was great for me also to pick it up after so many years. And I have very fortunate to have the Dell 4-color issue. I'm reading with the Fantagraphics one here, and I read it 3 times just in the last few days. And we'll talk about it. I read some kind of critical reviews of it as well, which were helpful, but it'll be interesting to dive into this.
Yeah, sure. Everyone can't feel the same way about every story. All right. So just a little bit of the numbers, a little bit of the background. This, The Golden Helmet, was published in May of 1952. It was created at the very end of December. And 4-color, 408. This one has just a boatload of reprints, as you would expect, including the original. It's seen 15 printings in various forms and formats in the States. It is one of his long 32 pagers. You know, I'm just going to kind of open with this, right? I usually save the index stuff for the end, but Like, I think it's important to ask ourselves at the outset of this episode, does the Golden Helmet live up to its reputation? Does it live up to the heights of how the community views it? Because this one is the highest rated Donald Duck story. The community ranking is number 3 on Indux, and that places it only below Back to the Klondike and Tra-la-la, which of course are Scrooge stories.
That's correct.
So, yeah. So
as a solo Donald Duck story, there is no Scrooge, there is no Gladstone, there's no Daisy. The nephews are in it, but they're secondary. I think this is really a key story that explores Donald's humanity. Does it deserve that rating? I don't know. I think it deserves to be way up there because of its reputation and because of how it explores Donald's growth.
Yeah, and we'll check in kind of at the end. And, you know, I don't know that anyone can answer that question because it's criticism, right? It's right. But you know, your vanilla is my hot fudge sundae or whatever. But I think it's definitely worth kind of keeping that in the back of our mind that this is considered by many people the all-time greatest Carl Barks Donald Duck adventure. So the other through line to this one, as we go through this, Barks definitely has a theme here, something that he ties everything back to. This is a story that is all about masculinity, ruggedness, as he calls it, for better or for worse. That's the through line. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be keeping that in mind. And it's not necessarily something that has to age very well too, right? Like, mm-hmm. Austin, what do you think about that element of it? Does that make the story feel kind of dated to you?
I don't think that particularly. I don't think there's actually a ton, now that you mention it, that makes this feel dated. There is just like a bit of a novel element to it that I guess like by 50 standards was like crazy. I mean, not to say that in today, if like someone was declared as the owner of North America, that wouldn't be insane. But there's just something about it, like thinking about it from a 1950s mindset, that sort of shocks you a little bit more. So I guess it's not really dated or anything about the story as much as it all just feels like it might have worked a tiny bit better during the period, you know, which isn't a bad thing, of course, because Barks is timeless, but you know.
But some of them do feel a little bit like a time capsule in a way.
Oh, yeah.
So let's kind of talk about some of the background. I think it's well known that this was a very, at least it's well known among Barks fans, this was a really turbulent time, a very sad time, personally. Warren, I know you know a pretty good amount about that. Kind of refresh us. We don't need to go into like the super gory details, but
no. But he was ending his marriage with his second wife. He was up to his eyeballs in lawyers. He was dealing with alimony demands, and he was at the end of December 1951, when he was writing this story, many of the critics and authors that I read pointed this at his probably one of his two low points in his career, and this was in his midlife. His other low point came at the end of his life in some legal battles with his artwork, but this one happened when he was really productive, and he was in those glory years, that 1948, 49 to 53, kind of that wonderful golden age of Barks. So I believe he used that low point to work very, very hard at coming up with more creative stories. This particular story strikes me as one of his more adult stories, and that might be another reason it scores high.
I read it described as like very cynical, right? It's a pretty dark, somewhat mean story, or mean-spirited in some respects. Here is a quote that I saw that I'm sure you've seen about it too. Mm-hmm. He said that it was done at a time when my fortunes were at a very low ebb. I had just given everything I owned to my alcoholic ex-wife in exchange for my freedom.
Yeah, he continues, broke and in debt and facing years of stiff alimony at the age of 50. I chose to keep working, and I can recall one day when all the bad news struck me and I should have been heading for a bar, and instead I sat down like a zombie with a pad of paper and jotted down gags and plots and situations that seemed to pour into me from somewhere. The golden helmet must have been one of those situations.
Yeah, so that's pretty stark. You know, it came out of that low point. As you said, there's a lot of his greatest stories are from this period where he seems to have really poured himself into his work.
Yeah, I find it interesting because it does make sense. Now that I think about it, that it came out of like a dark period, because like something that people are always instructed to like tell like people who are going through bad times is like writing helps. And that's one of those pieces of advice you always hear and people just blow it off. But like to think about it, you know, the fact that Golden Helmet and I guess Only a Poor Old Man, if we're talking the same period, came out of this period of Barks' life, then like there's a lot of truth to that, you know, in a weird way. I mean, people say it all the time, but I mean, I know when I'm like at a low point, I just start scribbling ideas and writing. I mean, I'm a filmmaker and I write stories and everything. So, and that usually ends up being my best stuff. So, yeah.
Right. It was probably very, very therapeutic. So you guys, before we get into the story, I do want to, I haven't really mentioned the fact that this comic feeds into the history and kind of the mythology of the Vikings mm-hmm. in a really intriguing way. Vikings are kind of all the rage right now. There's a couple of big Viking, there's at least one big Viking show.
The current film out there called The Northmen. Mm-hmm.
Right, Northmen, and there's like The Vikings or something. It's interesting, like the Vikings are such a cool historical archetype. There's not as much Vikings in pop culture, I think, as you might expect.
Well, the only Vikings that we're familiar with here in Minnesota are the losing Vikings, and they've gone to the Super Bowl a few times and never has won. But right. No, there's no question that these Vikings are the motivation for Donald wanting to man up, if you will.
Yeah, it's an interesting way for him to play around with that theme of masculinity. So you guys, before we get into it, I did share a couple of the titles from around the world. I chose to keep in Scandinavia.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I'll start out with Norway.
Go for it.
That. Yeah. Norway translation for the Golden Helmet is Donald Duck og Gullhelmen. Pretty much a straightforward translation to Gold Helmet.
Right. Austin?
Sure. In Sweden, I'm going to try my best on this. Och den gillen hjälmen, I guess. I don't know. Which is another direct translation, Donald Duck and the Golden Helmet.
Right. And then for Denmark, I'm going to do Denmark. It's den gyllene hjelm. And again, it's a straight up translation. This is like a perfect title, I think. Why mess with it? That cover art is so arresting. And I guess it's worth mentioning that the helmet itself doesn't look like a real Viking helmet. Not even the like cliched horned Viking helmets. To me, it looks more like Roman almost.
Yeah, but you're right. It does not strike me as the classic Viking helmet that we grew up with.
No. But it looks, let's just say it, it looks rad.
Yeah.
it looks awesome. Little kid me just thought that helmet was the coolest looking thing. And then speaking of Denmark, you know, I held on to the Danish title because they love this story so much. I almost feel guilty not having a Dane on here to talk about this. But their like Ministry of Culture adopted this as part of the Danish canon in 2006. They published this work, this canon of works significant to Danish culture. And this was the only item. Of course, the classic Lego brick made it, but this is the only item that wasn't Danish.
Oh, wow. Well, they really adored Karl Barks as well, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought that was fun. So the last quote before we get into the story itself is a letter that Barks wrote with him revisiting the story years later. He said, I've just read the Golden Helmet story for the first time in many years. The amount of plotting in the script is amazing, and every device and situation seems to develop easily from what has gone before. I can offer no explanation of how I did it other than to say that I wrote and rewrote and repolished and double-checked backward and forward and counted syllables in the dialogue and read the stuff dozens of times for effectiveness and flow. The bogus Latin legal phrases are really meaningless other than as points of reference in a running gag. So, you know, he has some appreciation of how tight the story is. It's kind of a, if I do say so myself quote. I think he's right to take a victory lap with this one.
I'm really glad you shared shared that, because listening to Barks himself comment on how he created the stories years later, reflecting on them, is really great for storytellers and story makers like Austin and myself, who do that for a hobby or for a profession. That's part of the art of crafting.
I totally agree. I thought that was super cool hearing him talk back about what he thought about his process. I mean, obviously, that just gave me like major anxiety listening to how much work he put into it. But I mean, it totally paid off. And this is like an interesting comparison I want to draw. As far as like the comic animation larger medium, Carl Barks is definitely a genius, but I would also call Tex Avery a genius, who did, you know, Red Hot Riding Hood and all the Droopy cartoons at MGM. And he had a very similar process where he would inspect his films. I mean, like Barks was counting the syllables and everything. Tex would inspect his films by frame, right? Every single one of his films, frame by frame, and he would change every error. And it caused this major nervous breakdown where he actually left for years at a time. And then he had to come back because he was just such a perfectionist. So I find it interesting that that never affected Barks, or at least to my knowledge. If anyone listening knows otherwise, I mean, let us know, because I would think after 25 years of being so perfect, if that was what he did with every story, I would think he would have had to crack at some point.
Yeah, that well said. To me, what comes to mind is the fact that like this isn't what he really like wanted to do, right? It's interesting to me. He obviously came up through the Disney system doing the animated shorts and stuff, but he didn't love doing the ducks, right? He wanted to be doing Prince Valiant. And so it's especially impressive, I think, that he put so much effort and heart and perfectionism into these comics that were, I have no doubt that he enjoyed doing these, that some of them he did something just because it cracked him up or because it was a story he wanted to tell. But even in this one, right there, this literal story was kind of him wanting to tell a Prince Valiant type tale, or at least to draw something that looked like it could have been set there.
Yeah, he was so influenced by Hal Foster and the Prince Valiant stories. And it's evident as we see him hit the high seas here, but I think he absolutely thoroughly enjoyed that, considering the time in his life, and was a great way to cope with all the realities of what he was dealing with.
And Warren, you mentioned hitting the high seas. He loves his seafaring stories.
There's so many great ones. I can't begin to name them all. Probably the best when it comes to on the water and among the rocks.
Well, yeah, as far as just pure like seafaring and navigation itself, this is the one that is most like preoccupied. It does such a great job of giving you an idea of what it meant to navigate the North Seas before digital compasses and satellite navigation and everything like that. Yeah, and you and I, Warren, had mentioned way back when I had you on the first time with Luck of the North, we mentioned that as like kind of a dry run almost.
I think it was Golden a dry Helmet. Run for Golden Helmet, yeah. And when you think about it in Barks's time frame, that was just about 2 years from Luck of the North to Golden Helmet creation. And look at the maturity, look at all the work he did in that span of time.
So prolific. Let's do this, guys. We are going to talk the Golden Helmet. We're going to go through this story. I'm going to do the main kind of summarizing, but I want to hear you guys kind of page by page, and then I'm going to have you guys do certain sequences. So you guys, the Golden Helmet opens up in a museum with Donald being an assistant guard. Of course, he's an assistant. And this is just such a masterful opening to the story. I say that a lot, but it does such a great job of setting this up. First off, we get this like taste of Donald looking extremely bored, literally saying ho-hum. And he's kind of plodding sleepily through the exhibits. And you guys, the exhibits are wild. Barks had so much fun. There's this goofy looking sculpture called the God of Gab. These sculptures, they look like, I don't know, they have like a Mad Magazine vibe to me, or I don't know, Sergio Aragonés, or they're not very typical. Barksian, right? They're a little bit surrealistic. It looks like something that Van Horn, who came along later, frankly, would have drawn. But he's just pacing through the museum and he's pondering how he's been working here for 3 months and nothing has happened. And the reader is treated to this great view of this beautiful old Viking longship that has a caption placard indicating that it was dug up in Herring, Norway, buried by the Vikings about 920 AD. And this seems like a good job for Donald, but he is talking about how he's the rugged type and he craves adventure.
You know, on that last panel of the first page and throughout, while he's bored, his comment about being the rugged type, he doesn't do it with a lot of flair. It's just sort of mentioned. But the visual in the museum that he stares at every day is that Viking ship. And I think that just takes him back. I also wanted to call out the similarities a little bit to Lost in the Andes opening, when Donald, again, is one of his occupations is that of a museum janitor. And I think there he's like the third assistant to the second assistant or something. But Barks, his sense of humor in there was more in the writing, because Donald was enthusiastic about being the guard in the museum. And here, Barks's humor is all in the visual. And it's just, like you said, these surreal pieces of art, these Salvador Dali-like images and these great, I mean, my favorite is the Godiva's laundry bag.
What about you, Austin? What do you think of these museum pieces?
Yeah, you brought up the Mad Magazine comparison. You also mentioned William Van Horn, who I definitely think of. By contrast, I don't think anything like this would have ever been done by Don Rosa. My favorite is in the bottom left corner, this horribly wrinkled, sad, frowning face is just labeled Joy. It just feels like Barks is having just a total field day with this absolute garbage in the background. I just love it so much.
Yeah. It's amazing. I love the one that's labeled The Fight. It looks like Barks goofing on like surrealism, right? That's how I take it. I guess what's our overall vibe? What does Barks think of the 1950s era museum, right? It doesn't, to me, this Viking boat is an incredible thing to go visit, but this doesn't speak very well of the modern museum.
Oh, I think he's really critically kind of tearing that apart while he's focusing in this great, and I should say, probably only splash panel of this size in the entire comic. That central Viking ship is where he wants to take us. These other things are throwaway gags.
Right.
And I really don't think he was a fan of the modern art era.
Right. Yeah, he's really doing a good job of focusing our attention on that ship. And on to the next page, you know, he gives us some great perspectives over the course of the next few, all around the ship. The next page is really devoted to just seeing Donald at work. His daydreaming about being rugged, being like the old-time Vikings, and then contrasting it with the kinds of directions that he has to give to some really goofy looking people who want directions to the butterfly collection and the lace and tatting collection. It's a really striking contrast. And I'll throw it over to you guys, but before I do, can I point out that Donald appears to be really, really good at this job? Like he's been working for 3 months and he knows everything. He doesn't care.
I totally agree. I wanted to point out that I thought it was very interesting when you were talking about this page, Mark, and I was just scanning through it. I was thinking, you know, Donald's hit like this really low point in his life. And then I read the panel on the right side where he's thinking to himself that he's sunk so low. You don't even have to be able to read the text to tell. He's just got these total morons coming to him for these just goofy sounding exhibits. Like Barks conveys that point, like Donald has really hit rock bottom before his crazy overseas adventure, you know, which I really like. That's great storytelling.
Yeah. And hey, Austin, would you mind reading the panel right before that? It's a great kind of summation of his situation.
I actually really like this now that you mention it. Donald is googly-eyed staring at the Viking ship and says, Those old Vikings fought walruses and whales and savage tribes, and I tell goggle-eyed nature boys where to find butterflies. And what I find interesting is that, like, this is almost, I mean, not this particular situation, of course, but it's almost relatable in a sense, where, like, we've all been through that point in our lives where we stand around and we compare ourselves to others and we just think, I mean, I've sunk so low. And I think that's, like, a cool thing about Barks is that he makes this, you know, duck that in the cartoons just throws around stuff and screams at everyone, like, such a human character, which I always found very intriguing.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Warren, it strikes me here kind of reminiscing about Luck of the North, right? The through line in that one was Donald's guilt, his extreme sense of guilt. And the through line in this one is his, like, insecurity.
Oh, absolutely. That's greatly put, Mark. In this particular one, you're absolutely right. Especially in that last panel of the second page, because he says, I just want to pretend to be a He-Man. That says it all.
Yeah.
A few minutes on top of this ship, I'll be one. And think about this. The museum is a lonely place.
A lot of time to stew in your thoughts. You guys, before the next page, is the second goggle-eyed nature boy, is that Barks? First reference to, I'm reading that man as like a gay man. Am I off track there? He looks very like a dainty dandy.
The critics call them both effeminate men. The critics I read, both of them, the skinny one is more effeminate than the other one. That's an interesting take on it. Yeah.
The first guy looks to me more just like kind of a man child to me.
Yeah, just kind of a bookworm man child.
But neither of them are like hurting anyone, right? They're both totally harmless. It'll be interesting to revisit, you know, at the end. So on the third page, you know, as you mentioned, he's up on that ship pretending to be a He-Man. I don't think the museum's insurance would like that, but it does give him the moment to overhear who is going to turn out to be the villain of this story, rummaging around the old ship, looking for something in its hold. And Donald directs him away. And you guys, he's quite the villain, right? This is Azure Blue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm of two minds, right? Like it's a shame that he didn't use him again, but this also makes him a very singular presence. We just get a quick little taste of him, but we know that he is big trouble, right? Just from the sneer on his face.
Yeah, I love that about his character, the way like Barks almost built his face so it's naturally scowling with the skin coming down on the eyebrows and they're sticking up and all the wrinkles on the muzzle. I think the first panel here says it all. He's got this little crowbar and this tiny flashlight and he's poking it in. And it's like, what kind of a maniac is on an old Viking ship doing this stuff? You know, it's a perfect character beat. Sets it up really nice for the whole story.
Right. And so he makes up some excuse and Donald directs him away to the charts. And this on the next page, this has naturally piqued Donald's interest. So he goes down to investigate in the ship and he ends up finding in an old knot hole, there's a loose peg that reveals a roll of deer skin that he identifies as a map. It's a really cool moment of discovery. You know, like to me as a kid, it seemed very plausible, even if it's a little bit far-fetched.
I remember this point as a kid enjoying that sort of self-discovery. Very resourceful. He's pretty smart here about knowing what to do to find it and the way he finds it. This is a very memorable moment for me.
Yeah, and you're right. It's kind of a quiet moment, but I do find it very memorable. So he takes the chart. And we're going to meet one of the other small handful of new characters. He passes by this like mysterious, scowling stranger. We get a taste of his thought balloon. Austin, I really liked your reading of Donald's. Do you mind reading Azure Blue's thoughts for us?
So Donald runs by with the map and Blue says, by the 90 curses of the Northern Lights, that stupid guard found what I was looking for. You know, I mean, which is funny. I wanted to bring this up earlier. I think like Barks's world is based off a tiny bit too much of like coincidences. I always found it interesting that Donald just found like the right pillar that has the right knot hole with the right map that Blue was looking for, you know?
Right. Yeah, he's definitely got that hero's luck, that sort of hero's heat seeking for sure. But man, Blue's dialogue in this, or monologue in this case, I guess, is great. So Donald does take that role of Deerskin to the curator. And the curator is a really interesting guy, right? Because he is this old, bookish, academic looking guy. But we're going to see that he's really resourceful. He is really like great in a moment of crisis. And I really like him. It's a quiet little supporting role, but I've got a great deal of affection for the curator.
Yeah. And I will say, looking when we first meet the curator, he occupies such a great part of the first third of the story. And whereas no other regular character has been such a partner with Donald in plotting and in discovering. One of the critical essays I read about this story was there's a lot of similarities here between Indiana Jones going into the academics in the museum and into the college. Some parallels. And so, as we know, George Lucas and
Spielberg.
Steven Spielberg were influenced by Karl Barks greatly.
Yeah, that's a great point. Warren, tell us about the curator's interpretation of the deerskin.
Oh, well, the curator says that this map is a log of the old Viking ship. It tells the tale of its voyages, and it was commanded by a Viking named Olaf the Blue.
And it's pretty funny if you know your Viking history, right? Everyone knows Eric the Red. Great goof on that name.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. In fact, I really thought Olaf the Blue was real. So I started looking it up, and every reference went right back to Karl Barks.
Right.
But yeah, years before Eric the Red, and in 901, he landed on the coast of North America, the all important discovery here that we're talking about the fate of North America, the entire continent.
Yeah. And he finishes by, you know, giving our little artifact its introduction. He mentions that he buried a golden helmet, and he gives the latitude 59 degrees on the coast of Labrador. So Barks, he's laying out, you know, our destination, and this villainous scowling man has been listening in, and he's kind of musing about how all of the information that he had translated previously in Norway are fitting together, and he gets ready to act. You guys, I want to just detour for a moment. I feel like Barks was ahead of the curve. I have no doubt he got this from National Geographic, right? But like, if you look up articles about when, you know, America was, quote, discovered, and we know there are lots of issues with like discovery is silly for a land that was already populated. But you'll see references from like into the 21st century about new evidence suggests that the Vikings were the first. And I felt like because I read this story as a kid, I knew better than most people that the Vikings had been here longer than Columbus, for example.
And growing up here in Minnesota, part of the Northland, and in Viking lore and Norwegian immigrants came over, very big part of our history here in the state. And to kind of see this come about, and Barks is educating the reader about this from his time with National Geographic, but also with his love for history. I think this is one of the most compelling moments of any of his stories.
Right. And he's definitely going to stretch historical fact to its breaking point, but he does it in such a great, entertaining way. And so on to the next page, Donald and the curator are exulting at his discovery. And before the curator is able to send an expedition to Labrador, they get interrupted by that man. Austin, do you want to tell us about the pair of people that interrupt?
So as your Blue walks back in with a new character who kind of has like the same facial structure going on, who introduces himself as Lawyer Sharky, who's here to demand possession of that map for my client here, Azure Blue, eldest descendant of Olaf the Blue. Really funky Barks-esque looking characters here. We already talked about how great Blue's design was.
Yeah.
How awesome is the lawyer's? No. I mean, Barks draws funny also, which is like another thing he has going for him.
Yeah. Sharky is hilarious, right? He's got like this permanent sneer. And we talked about how this is Barks' hate letter towards lawyers, right? He felt like he just finished getting screwed over by a lawyer in his divorce proceedings. And he like poured some of that venom into this depiction. I love Sharky. He cracks me up. I do find that like hook nose just a little bit uncomfortable. It is viewed by some people as a bit of an anti-Semitic trope. I'm not suggesting that like he was purposefully depicting him that way, but like I do think that's something that kind of got absorbed into the pop culture. So that part of him I find a little bit disquieting, but Sharky is hilarious. His like sort of venomous legalistic interpretation is one of the better running gags, I think.
Interesting. I never saw that myself, but again, you know, you're right. That he appears more haughty and upper scale. I mean, he's got the bow tie, he's got the tuxedo, I mean the long tails.
Right.
I just wanted to say, like, that was what came to mind for me too. But you took the words right out of my mouth. I mean, it was just like in the pop culture almost, which sounds like horrible to say, but like right. it's what came to my mind at first. But just like a hook nose is just something that a lot of people were putting on a lot of different characters at the time.
Right. So. It's not an indictment of Barks specifically. It's an indictment of the consciousness of pop culture. So yeah, you guys, this Code of Discovery in one of his longer narrator boxes, it's a work of genius, I think, because like it is at the same time completely over the top and ridiculous. And yet for like the young readers reading it, it felt so ironclad. I don't know.
I bought it.
As a 9-year-old reading this, I bought it. It felt like it invoked almost the Magna Carta to me, yeah. Right? Like, oh yeah, yeah, it feels like something that must have happened at the time. But this idea that, you know, it says that the rulers of all the nations gathered in Rome and drafted a law which read, any man who discovers a new land beyond the seas shall be the owner of that land unless he claims it for his king. And so Barks tells us directly the stakes here. Since Olaf the Blue claimed North America for his own, it now belongs to his nearest of kin. And has there ever been a higher stakes outside of maybe in ancient Persia? This has to be the Barks story with like the very highest of stakes.
I think it is. I oh my goodness. You mean the whole fate of North America is at stake here?
And so the curator, of course, objects, right? He says, horseradish and pure bunkum. How can that man prove he is Olaf's nearest of kin? Warren, I'll let you do the first of Sharky's legalese dog Latin.
Flicus, flaccus, fum, deedly dum, which is legal language for how can you prove that it isn't? Love it.
And yeah.
And then, of course, Azure Blue snatches the map away from a very distressed looking curator.
And so they leave and Sharky gets the last word. They imply that, you know, they're going to enslave them once they get the golden helmet, which is what they need to prove his ownership. Austin, what's the next bit of dog Latin?
Hocus, locus, jocus, which means I have no idea what. To the landlord belong the doorknobs.
Oh, it's such a great turn of phrase.
It doesn't even make sense. Like the more you think about it, it's just so bizarre, but it's just so awesome.
I love those.
I mean, drawing your parallels between owning an entire continent to owning a piece of property, like an old tenement, classic Barks humor.
And so on the next page, you know, we've got the curator and he's dazed. And what Barks is doing here is that the curator is like our voice of authority, right? He is taking it seriously for us so that we will, because Donald is like, this sounds like preposterous. And he's saying, I'm just going to go bash him on the head. What a great shot of him getting ready to peg him with his baton. But then the curator is setting up the stakes. Like, we have to stop him and we have to be the ones he can legally do this. And if he is able to get the helmet, then it's true. The law is sound. And so what the curator does is he reproduces the map, and he is they're going to set out separately. They're going to head to Labrador, as Donald says, among the icebergs and polar bears. And the curator points out, Olaf the Blue did it. Are we less of men than he was? And so we've got the stakes. They're set up. The curator and Donald are going to head out in separate paths. Donald will sail up the coast. The curator will head an overland route. And so he gives him, you know, enough money to make an expedition. And as Donald leaves, pondering, wow, I was just thinking, you know, nothing exciting happens anymore. It's a good thing I'm the rugged type. The curator instructs him, make sure you chuck that golden helmet into the ocean. It is dangerous.
I love that discovery for the reader, seeing that in that last panel. And the shot's beautiful with the curator in the background.
I totally agree. I was about to say, Warren, the composition is great, and the statement is foreshadowing for what I always thought was the stronger half of the story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Austin.
Ooh, I like that. You have got a statement. You think that the second half is the stronger half, huh?
I really like the drawing in the first half with all the scenes in the storm, but I think there's some really cool like commentary on humanity almost, like at the end with we don't want to spoil it, but what happens with the helmet and all the, you know, everyone.
Right. Yeah. As if anyone listening to this has not read this one. Yeah. All right. So Warren, why don't you tell us about the sequence where they prepare?
Sure. So Donald races home to let the boys know that they're off to Labrador. And the kids are just sitting on the living room floor playing marbles and kind of disinterested in anything. And Donald just has, again, a classic fit and explains to the boys, we're going to Labrador. And is that a movie? And he gets so frustrated. One of my favorite panels. And he throws himself headfirst into the wall, just out of sheer frustration over the, oddly enough, the roles have been reversed here for a few panels, because it would be typically the nephews who would know all this. And Donald is just frustrated. They don't have any idea what's going on. So then they skip to the where they're on the plane heading toward Labrador. Well, it just amazed me, too, that they're on this great airplane flying over, night shot of the plane. It's an overnight trip. But then they're in this beautiful bed where Donald's on one side and the nephews are on the other side in a plane, in a passenger plane. Well, that's pretty luxury traveling for 1950. Donald is now kind of relishing in his newfound adventure here. No more old musty museums for me, just the northern seas out there, and let the softies study their butterflies and tatting. And as they kind of land in Newfoundland, the ducks discover there at the docks, they see Azure Blue loading a boat full of everything and everybody, including newspaper reporters.
Yeah, this kind of reminded me of like Gladstone and Donald getting ready to take off in the race to the South Seas.
Yeah, very similar.
Yeah, we've got this like pursuit, and he's even got a warship, Azure Blue.
Yeah, out there, ominous warship in the waters.
He's clearly a big deal. I'm going to ask Austin to kind of tell us some of their voyage.
Sure. I want to comment first, though. I think it's super cool the way Barks keeps bringing up, the panel with the plane shot, erase it will decide the fate of the people of North America. And then again, when the ducks are looking at Blue loading up the ship, we just have these people on the side going, this helmet that will make him the owner of North America. You know, he just keeps re-emphasizing those stakes because it speaks volumes about how powerful the story is, which I just think is so cool.
I'm glad you brought that up, Austin. It looks like a worldwide event. This is a big deal.
Yeah, so Austin, tell us about their voyage.
Sure. So Donald sets off after Blue, and it's a pretty rough day out on the seas. Bunch of water's hitting Donald in the face. He's got a very unusually determined character. Let him scoot. It isn't speed that's going to win this race. It's ruggedness. You know, back to that key plot element of the ruggedness, I guess. So they keep going, and there's some arguing between Donald and the nephews about where they are and the compass. And I mean, in reality, none of them know what they're doing because they don't do this stuff very often. But so they're all in the same boat for once, Donald and the nephews, which I find kind of interesting. So again, on the next page, there's some more rough weather on the seas, and Donald's in a raincoat this time with the nephews all beaten up, hanging on to this the base of the flagpole. And anyway, we cut ahead to Blue in the warship. And what I find very interesting is that, you know, this crazy weather where even the nephews that are, you know, usually the determined type in these stories have almost totally given up where they're hanging on for dear life. Donald is determined and he's equal with Blue, who is, you know, the warship's leaving, sir. Shall we turn back to, which is what someone's saying to a Blue on the ship. And he goes, hold your course. I'm giving orders here, which sounds so stupid, you know? I mean, there's so much at risk, but I mean, he's such a crazy character, Blue. Just,
it's interesting to see Blue comfortable in like a cabin, right? While the ducks are exposed to the elements in their smaller ship.
It's wonderful to see him in that environment, holding a gun on the captain of the ship and also his lawyer in tow. I mean, this lawyer is going everywhere with him. That struck me funny the first time.
You guys, the sea, the storm, all of these panels are just drawn so beautifully here. This is the part in the podcast where I commit that cardinal sin of, you know, verbally describing some great visuals, but they're just stunning.
Well, I'll second that on the stunning artwork. Those first two pages when he sets off are just unbelievable in execution, and it really does rival Hal Foster's art from Prince Valiant.
He wanted to do this. It's a shame he couldn't have given himself more excuses to do that kind of art. So basically this storm, the purpose of the storm is to equalize Donald and Blue. He points a gun at the captain. I like how we up the stakes here, right? Like he's a bad villain. We've got some gunplay in our Disney comic here, and he just, you know, alludes to, I'm going to be the first to that golden helmet. I'll take Sharky's dog Latin here. He says Iocus crocus spocus, which means the boss speaketh a jawful. And just at that moment, of course, they crash between a couple of icebergs and they get shipwrecked. So he gets a little bit of comeuppance there briefly. And the ducks, they see that they managed to pass them. They see the lifeboats and they celebrate. But Azure Blue, Donald does not actually see Azure Blue in those boats. So he's not ready to celebrate. And we do flash forward. Sharky and Blue are in a rowboat, very riskily, rowing towards their destination. And Blue, you know, thinks that, you know, we're bound to have something break our way. And boy, I guess, Warren, we've got another parallel that I didn't think about with Lost in the Andes, where we've got a bit of an extended fog sequence.
We do. And
Barks needed a little break after after laboriously, painstakingly drawing all those crashing waves. You
know, that's really a good point, because drawing each of those panels in the previous three or four pages had to be labor intensive. But let's just throw in a few horizontal lines and some gray paint, and let's call it fog. So I think he does a nice job of that, and it adds to the storyline of how close these boats are really becoming to the icebergs and to the danger out here. And the nephews are out there, of course, asking Donald to look out.
It's a really neat sequence here, what they figure out. You want to tell us how they head off, you know, how they keep safe in the fog?
Yeah, so so he says, I discovered something. If we yell, we can see the bergs, see them by listening to the echoes as they bounce off of the large icebergs. And so they start yelling to gauge their closeness to the icebergs. I think that's just brilliant.
It's really clever. It feels like, if you're a kid, it feels really clever. But of course, it leads to Azure Blue localizing them and boarding their boat at gunpoint, leaving them adrift in just a rowboat.
I thought this earlier when Blue pulled the gun on the captain, but I think here, really, and I think we might be at the halfway point in the story, is where stuff gets serious, you know, where they run into Azure Blue and Lawyer Sharky on the rowboat and he pulls that gun on Donald, you know, where it's like the stakes are really high. And as we're about to see, I mean, Donald is really America's only hope here. So I think this is where it starts to become like a real nail biter, which I think is like the best part.
Yeah, that's a really good point, right? Because what Barks is doing is these two competing parties are getting like whittled down, right? Each of them gets left high and dry more and more. And Austin, you alluded to Donald being the only hope. Why is that?
Well, we check in on the curator who's taking the land route, and it looks like the helicopter that he was in has broken down. The motor's burned out, and it's going to take 3 days to hike back for repairs. And, you know, he can yell all he want, but, you know, it's 3 days, and he better start walking because, is it latitude or longitude 59? Over off the coast of Labrador is 100 miles away. So there goes the curator, and he's hiking, and he says, again, just Barks nailing in those stakes. Donald is America's only hope.
Yeah, you really feel for the curator because he definitely does not look like a young man.
No, he's not. He's a seasoned curator of the museum. And by the way, he has no name. He's just known as the curator, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
But he's also as determined as Donald to make the trip. And so he starts a 100-mile trek.
Yeah.
In pretty dangerous country.
Right. Yeah, you feel for him. My feet have like sympathy blisters for him. And we get another of those, like, Blue alluded to his luck turning around. That's what happens next for the Ducks, is they encounter some of the wreckage of his ship, and they're able to fashion a sail. And, boy, every one of Bark's little narrator panels, I feel like his narrator panels are more interesting than in the average story. They're, like, cheering him on, right? The wreckage is a priceless find. Out of it, they fashion a mast and mount a sail made from the canvas sea anchor. And the nephews point out in an annoyed way that Donald's getting to live just like the Vikings did 1,000 years ago. We see this really cool. I love the panel where he does like the manual sighting of the stars. It really fires the imagination, I think.
Well, he's also sharing his expertise in navigation, which we didn't know he had. Of course, he's a sailor duck, I guess you could say.
Sure. I imagine that he got it in his like 3 months in the museum.
Yeah, you know, yeah. But I love that pose. That's a very, very unusual angle that we see Donald. He does it with such, just great flair. I just love this, the silhouette use here.
And so finally they do reach that latitude, the latitude 59, they head west, and they, I didn't mention, but they're supposed to be looking for a headland that's shaped like a cross, is where Blue is buried, has hidden the helmet.
That's correct.
And guys, what do we think about that lower splash panel? Austin, do you want to read when they finally sight land? What does one of the nephews say?
So they get to this great pile of rocks, this great Bark splash panel, and they say, Olaf the Blue must have felt the same way. That's the ickiest view of America I've ever seen. I mean, I agree with them. Oh my God, it is just drop dead gorgeous, though. I mean, it is a very unwelcoming sight. I mean, you've got shadows over the rocks and the rocky tide, and I actually never noticed like the little penguin puffins in the bottom left corner.
Yeah. I love the little bit of puffins that are featured in this.
Oh, I love the introduction, and Austin, you nailed it. I agree with you. The sheer scale of this panel, and I wish it was larger.
Ugh.
You know, here it's only one of the two frame or two panel squares that it takes up on the lower part of a page. Again, there are very few splash panels, if any, in this story, but it is probably my favorite bigger panel and a scale with that sailboat.
Yeah, it's stunning. It's such a great panel. This is a really cool sequence here. The Ducks, now they have to just basically scan the coast. They have to hope that the curator's map has led them roughly in the right direction. And they don't know it, but they're competing with Azure and Sharky, who are doing the same thing on their old boat at this moment. But neither of them are having any luck. And we see them on kind of the opposite sides of a little rock island. And as they round it and spot each other, we get this great taste of Azure Blue's treachery. As soon as he sees the ducks, he yells at Sharky to ram their boat and sink it. That miserable museum guard is not going to beat me to the golden helmet.
Yeah, that's a great confrontation there. But I'm going to go back just a frame or two there, Mark, and comment about another characteristic trait of that lawyer who's just
Thank you.
Because I think this is where we start talking about, well, I suggest that you sue somebody, anybody, for millions of dollars of damages. This is Carl Barks's disdain for lawyers right here. He was living it in his real life. They were suing him for divorce. They were, I don't want to get into all that, but this is a clearly completely different thought at the time when, and of course, Azure Blue agrees with him, then the confrontation.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed it out. It's the other great running gag with Sharky, besides the ridiculous dog Latin, where he's constantly suggesting suing for damages in an over-the-top way. What do you think of his, like, treachery here, Austin, just ramming their boat?
God, he is just so villainous, you know? I think it really just solidifies, like, the stakes and the point. I mean, America's only hope has just been sunk in the mid. Oh, my God. He's climbing up the rocks on the side with his nephews. He's thankful that he wasn't shot at. I mean, it's a really well-structured story at this point. I mean, this is why I was saying earlier, like, the second half is my favorite of the two, just because it gets really suspenseful at this point. And Donald hit a high where he's at that adventure that he wanted at the beginning, and now he's back at a low that he started at, you know, which I find very interesting.
It's definitely the like more exciting half, but I think they work together so well. But man, you're right, Austin, every panel in this sequence is just an utter work of art. The ducks, like, scrambling helplessly, bedraggled onto these cold rocks. Azure Blue's great pose as he's, like, menacing them, talking about taking care of rugged runts like you in rugged ways. And then Lady Luck takes a turn against Blue as his motor conks out, I suspect because he just rammed another vessel. And in turn, it's going to smile. Lady Luck, Fortune, is going to smile on the ducks, who are huddling at, like, a little campfire they've made in a puffin nest. You guys, this is such a wonderful sequence. This is, like, such a thrilling bit of discovery. It fired my imagination so much as a kid. We've got three of the ducks huddled for warmth, while one of the ducks is kind of at the edge of the water overlooking the island that they had just kind of met, encountered Azure Blue around. And he asks Donald how long ago Olaf drew the map. And Donald is, like, shivering in disgust, and he says, 1,000 years, what difference does it make? And the camera pulls to the space between the island and that little point that they're huddling for warmth on, and Huey says nothing, except that in 1,000 years, the waves could have cut through the neck of that headland. And it's just such a thrilling moment. It really sends, like, a little chill up my spine.
The thrilling moment, you're right, and it's this moment of discovery when you are discovering the eroded rock that once was the cross that made that headland 1,000 years ago, and you can see the remnants of it there. That's where your imagination kicks in. And I think this is great for that young reader, the old reader, for any reader, because this is an adventure story in the vein of an Indiana Jones. And now we're seeing the nephews and Donald work together really well. The resourcefulness of Dewey and Donald now getting it. These are probably one of my favorite sequences in the whole story.
It's got to be one of the best sequences in any of Bark's adventures. It's because you're filled with such a sense of excitement, right? You're like, you know that they're close. You know what's about to happen.
I was just going to throw in, like, I think it's really cool the way that Bark structures the nephews and Donald, like, dynamic. Like, Donald is good at sort of, in this case, determination, and also sort of aggressiveness and fighting back, because he's so dead set on finding this helmet. And the nephews, you know, they're junior woodchucks and they've got the guidebook. They don't have it on them, but I'm sure they're well read into it. And they're able to look over this cliff and go, well, wait a minute. If it's been, you know, a millennium's worth of time, this headland could have worn down and we might be standing right on top of the helmet. So, you know, I just find it interesting the way that Barks evens it out so that different plot points can be hit by different characters for different reasons, just speaking to their different strengths.
Right.
Yeah, very well said. And so Donald pulls out that copy of the curator's copy of the map, and he looks to where he thinks it should be. And sure enough, they see a really suggestive cairn of rocks lying where no man-made formation should be, with a grumpy-looking puffin nested atop. And I love the bit where Donald gets, like, quote, crowned by the helmet. Couple of puffin eggs break on him. Barks really likes to do that, right? He likes to take Donald down a peg right at those moments of triumph.
That's a good point.
And to, like, really add some punch to their almost discovery, we transition back over to Sharky and to Azure and Sharky, who've just gotten the motor working again. And Azure is going to just take a scan for the ducks. And we get this really cool perspective shot through his binoculars. And in the narrator box, Austin, can you tell us what Azure screams?
Another bit of classic Barks writing, classic blue line. By the seven teeth of the sea witch, screams Azure Blue, they found the golden helmet. And we have this awesome image, just like the cover of Donald, triumphantly holding just this awesome looking helmet in his arms, and the nephews are all happy. I didn't notice it. Has it been up to this point where the narrator box are reading off, like, almost like a kid's book, you know, with that line, like, screams Azure Blue, like they're being told from, like, the third person?
Yeah, it's interesting that sometimes he feels like he's almost having a conversation with the reader in those narrator boxes in a way that I find really endearing. I like it. It's really striking too. I think I never remember as much as I've read this, I never remember that great cover shot is really like a shockingly small bit of a regular panel, because it fills your imagination so well.
Well, it shows Donald in his greatest triumph of his whole career. In now he's suggesting that he's saved North America in this little, you know, through the binocular shot. But as Austin and all of us agree, it made for one of the most iconic covers ever.
Yeah, absolutely. And so Blue, of course, is enraged and he wants to immediately go commandeer the helmet, but Sharky is like, oh, let's be sneaky and smart about this. And so they make their way to ambush the ducks from behind. And we see the ducks kind of basking in their discovery. We get this great shot of Donald holding the helmet aloft. It's a beauty. It is really iconic to me. He's going out of his way to draw our eyes to the helmet. And then all of a sudden, of course, it gets snatched away by Azure Blue, who introduces himself as the Emperor of North America to you, slave. and he's triumphant now. He gives this really creepy, leering grin. And he's talking about how the deerskin map and the golden helmet are his deed to North America. Next bit of dog Latin, Warren.
Well, his lawyer, lawyer Sharky, then says, Octus Soctus Bombificus, meaning, that's telling them, boss. But this is absolutely, again, he's smiling here, too.
Grotesquely.
Grotesquely smiling, yes. And then they are claiming that they are the slaves and you'll work for me every day with no Sundays off. He's holding onto the map and the helmet with such greed. It's amazing.
Right. And the, you know, the ducks are outraged. And as they're just triumphant, the nephews very cutely say, you won't take our junior woodchuck trophies, nor Donald's new television set. And they don't care about this stuff, but they want to drive the point home. So another bit of dog Latin, Sharky says, oh, yes, he will. Clunkus, bunkus, skunkus. It is the law. And he is holding them at gunpoint, telling them to get on and be my crew so that I can head back to Newfoundland and be crowned. And of course, that's our cue for him to get a big stone landing right on his head. Tell us, Austin, about who saves the day.
So the curator's back into play, who I guess the readers all forgot about. He's looking worried and distraught as usual. He throws the rock on Blue's head. Bind that fiend, boys. The helmet must not be allowed to fall into his hands again. It's best that we sail at once and dump these things far at sea. So, you know, he's like, he's almost stepping in as like the practical one where he just knows it's going to be taken a bit too far. Now, I mean, of course it has been already, but I mean, it's almost necessary for the story for him to be here just to be like, we have to get rid of this. You know, it's just a powerful tool, which leads us the climax, which is the best part here.
And the curator is horribly tired here. He's just walked 100 miles. So hearing him say this, you believe in him and you say, okay, well, this is going to be the end. But you're right. This is the climax.
Right. And he's going to be the only one sitting on the boat as they're sailing out to dump it. And this is such, you're right, Austin, this is such a great sequence. We get Sharky whispering as like the devil on his shoulder. Sharky is just a greedy cliche of a lawyer. He is trying to convince the curator that these are your deeds to North America now. You've got it. And, you know, the curator kind of asks him, what payment? We're not meant to think he's taking it seriously. He's just kind of asking, what payment would you expect for being my lawyer, Sharky? This is going to be another great gag near the end where his fee is always something exorbitant, like, say, Canada. And this is really cool. We've gotten kind of some hints of this before. But now the helmet itself is kind of taking on this like power. And whether you think there's some supernatural element or it's just the promise of all that power, which is like too much for one human to literally hold in their hands, right? It is this corrupting thing, like the One Ring and the Lord of the Rings.
That's right.
But it's doing it to the curator. And the nephew, one of the nephews, eyeballs the curator and notices that the old gent's getting a strange gleam in his eye. And that gleam is going to be our warning that a character has been corrupted. And suddenly the curator gets over his exhaustion and tells Donald to turn southward because he has decided that he'll be the owner of North America. Warren, how does he deal with the fact that he's not Olaf's next of kin?
Well, now the curator wakes up. He's holding the deed. He's holding the helmet. And Donald claims, well, you're not the next of kin because you're not a kin of Olaf the Blue. Sharky clearly says it again. Flickus, flaccus, fum dillium dum. How can you prove that he isn't? It's the second time he's used that line, and he'll continue to use that line, and the gleeful curator is just holding onto that helmet with dear life. And then he says, proclaim that Sharky's absolutely right. I can own North America. This map and the helmet are my deed to the continent.
Yeah. Austin, any comments? And if no, can you tell us about the curator's plans?
Man, I'm just shaking my head over here. Like, it just gets so ridiculous.
I
just love it so much. I mean, on my first read, right, holding the Gladstone print in my hands, at the end, they've got the helmet, the curator stepped in, and I'm feeling the pages, and I'm like, wait a minute, there's too much to go. It's not over yet. So, like, this is just a seriously bizarre turn. So we turn the page, and the curator is just so excited. I'll run the country for the benefit of the museums. Everybody will have to go to a museum twice a day. And oh my God, he is just going berserk over museums. Every Sunday, there's going to be a museum party. People will bring their lunches and study ancient bric-a-brac. I love that line. You know, he just walked 100 miles. So while he's rambling on and on, he just totally dozes off. And Donald picks up the helmet and tries to throw it away.
Oh, it's great. I love the nephew's reaction to what the curator has in mind. One of them's like, ugh, I think I liked Azure's deal better, where he was going to be enslaved. What a great moment here. It's so rapid fire, right? As soon as the curator falls, Donald picks it up and he winds way back and he kind of freezes in place. And a nephew, in my print, it's Huey, he yells at him, "Throw it! Don't you go getting a gleam in your eye." What do you think, Warren, about Donald's vision?
Well, Donald's vision is, interestingly, he has the cloud of this king of North America holding the throne, sitting on a throne, holding the helmet, wearing a crown, grasping the deed. He looks all powerful, yet the image of his wide-eyed stare, you almost wonder if he's in that same kind of trance at this point. But yeah,
I think it's so funny. It's just the vision of him as king of North America.
And it adds to the slapstick of the sequence. I mean, the trade-off back and forth from crashing boats to who's got the helmet. And now we're back in Donald's hands. He's definitely seeing this vision of grandeur for himself. But there he is again, Sharky, whispering in Donald's ear, "Tempting spot you're in. I'll gladly be your lawyer for a fee, of course." And then, of course, is it Huey who says, "Uncle Donald, throw that doggone helmet in the ocean."
Yeah.
He just proclaims, "No, I see no reason why I shouldn't be king of North America. I can be King Donald, the Viking kid."
Yep.
Nephew's just taking over the Latin. Flickus, flaccus, fumbly umdum, meaning we're back on the hook again. And they just look like they've had it.
What do you guys think about Donald's grand scheme here?
Oh, it's scary.
it's pretty gruesome, right? It's
really gruesome.
It's creepy. What does he want to do, Austin?
He wants to just let people go on just as they are. I won't take a thing away from them. Let them have all the land and oil wells and mines they want, which is just, it's creepy because, like, if you think about society functioning like that, it's like, what? That is insane. That is not how anything works.
Oh, I like Sharky egging Donald on over his air metering scheme here, that a sigh could cost a nickel, a gasp, a dime. What a creepy concept, right?
Well, to own the air that everybody breathes, charging people.
Yeah. Yeah. To take a breath. It really horrified me as a kid that, like, Donald was suggesting this.
And, like, at this point, the reader is just on the edge of their seat. Like, imagine life with Donald as your ruler. I mean, you couldn't manage with that, man.
Yeah, and Barks does a great job of making Donald look, like, really unhinged. It's great. Every expression here is awesome. We get our dog Latin, where the nephews comment, "Griftus, graftus, gaspus," on the next page. Uncle Donald's turned out to be a dirty snake.
See, Donald, I agree with you, and I think Donald would not have had this without the influence, whatever you want to call it the curse of the helmet, but there is something otherworldly about this helmet. Well,
Do you guys think it's got a supernatural power? It's just, like, you know, classic power corrupts.
I think it's just like power corrupt. You know, there's a different character having a different reason each time it's picked up, and it works, like, perfectly well with who they are. Just like Donald is so nonsensical. He has no clue what he's talking about in any way. Like, going back to what I was saying about, like, Barks's commentary almost on, like, society and, like, how people function, is just people get these crazy ideas when they're in, like, a situation of power. I mean, you just read this stuff like, a gasp is a dime. I mean, what are you talking about? You know? Yeah, it's just beyond.
Oh, it's great. What do you think, Warren? Supernatural?
I wanted to think it was. However, listening to Austin and thinking again about this time in Barks's life, when he must have felt that everything he did was like every little innocent move was being taken away from him. To me, I'm thinking this thing does hold some sort of power, not maybe within the metal of the helmet, but maybe just within the idea of having it. And of course, it doesn't help at all to have Sharky over everyone's shoulder, right, wanting a piece of this action.
I think it's just the power corrupting, personally, yeah, but it's funny either way. So, you know, but it really does number on Donald, right? Because he literally maroons his own nephews. This is a heartbreaking moment, right? This is some terrible villainy, and you can only excuse it because of the stakes and the corrupting influence of the helmet. He drops them off, at least with some supplies, on an iceberg, intending to send a ship back to rescue them once he's king. One of the nephews, though, has swiped the compass, which is a great move, right? It's a great bit of sabotage, but it's also a bit of self-sacrifice because, you know, one of the others points out how can anyone come back and rescue us? All right, so we're coming on to the closing out of the story where Donald is like lost in the Northern Oceans. The kids and the curator and Azure are just drifting on the iceberg they're marooned on. There's the weather is against them. While they're marooned on the iceberg, the kids are kind of talking about what they know. They realize, hey, icebergs drift south. So if we can shape the iceberg using the axes that their uncle left, they can get the berg to move even faster. And as we transition back to Donald and Sharky, they're drifting in some fog. Austin, can you tell us? I really like this sequence. Tell us about what happens.
Yeah, I really like what's coming up. So Sharky and Donald are just going along. And Sharky's trying to tell him he should shut off the engine and save the gas. But as usual, Donald thinks he knows better. And he goes, look, I see a pair of lights, two of them winking right up ahead. They crash into something and it ends up being an iceberg. And the two lights being a polar bear's eyes. So the polar bear comes on and he chases Sharky and Donald up the flagpole. He comes on, he eats all the supplies, and then he leaves them both stranded with nothing left but the helmet on the boat alone.
Isn't it kind of funny how we get this big peril of a polar bear and we never really get a good look at it?
No, we really don't get that.
It reminded me that there's such a quick like image of a polar bear in Luck of the North too.
Yes. Yes.
The whole interaction with the polar bear is like almost more comical than threatening, because like Donald Sharky's like, I don't know what we're going to do. Ask the bear. He's the new captain.
Right.
And then he leaves like just absolutely huge with his pilfered food. And this leads us into a classic like starving to death, adrift in the ocean, where Donald and Sharky are musing about what they would give away for a hamburger.
Well, he would give away the state of California because he owns North America now. So he would give away California for a hamburger.
But Sharky says, you wouldn't get it from me that cheap. And Donald starts to wallow, you know, wondering if this isn't his punishment for his behavior and trying to get something from nothing. And Sharky definitely won't hear of that because he's a slimy lawyer.
That's right.
And this is really timed so well, right? Donald is stewing and he sees a silhouette in the distance that he believes to be Olaf the Blue and his old Viking ship to take revenge.
It's a wonderful ghostly image, too.
It really is.
And I think that's exactly what scares him enough to maybe even convince him that he shouldn't have had this.
Yeah. And it turns out, Austin, what does it turn out to be?
It ends up just being the nephews on an iceberg Viking ship, a hot rod iceberg, as they call it, just out trying to look around. So Donald's thrilled to see them. Sharky grabs him by the back. Don't be rash, sir. Grab their compass and some food. You can still be King Donald, the Viking kid. And Donald thinks a few things over and he decides he doesn't want to, because I think he had that little existential crisis, almost philosophical moment where he's like, I wonder if this is punishment, trying to get something from taking what wasn't mine. Like, I think that's very interesting. Barks doesn't go into like philosophy territory very often. I think that gives the story like more of a serious vibe.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, right? Because I think he has a moment where he's like, wow, I've been given this second chance. I can take some redemption here. And if I don't, I'm lost, right? So he's going to do the right thing. And then the inevitable thing happens. What we knew might as well have happened all the time. The true villain of the story, lawyer Sharky, grabs the helmet, demands that he'll become lawyer of emperor, owner of North America, emperor of everything. And you guys, I love how the nephews are just, they're just going to wrap this up with no muss, no fuss.
They've had enough is enough. No more.
Don't you think this real estate trading has gone on long enough? What a great wise guy way of putting it. What's Warren, what's the nephew's response?
Yikus, yakus, you bet us, meaning yes. We and agree it's gone on too far. And then, of course, they grab a mackerel or a fish and they slap it. They throw it across the bow of the boat. It hits Sharky in the face. And finally, the helmet and the map land in the ocean.
Yeah, pretty unceremoniously, right?
Yeah.
And we get this great, like, parting view of one of the nephews, kind of forlornly looking, musing how now no one will own North America. Yeah. And one of his brothers says, get that look off your face. Darned if you weren't getting a gleam in your eye. Just gives him a swift kick in the butt.
Yep.
It's a perfect ending. And then it's capped with another great ending. It's such a nice bookend, right? Donald, he goes back to the museum. He was really good at doing that. And he needs to, I think he kind of needs to process everything that's happened, right? And what better place to process it than right in front of that ship? And so in his museum garb, he's gazing at the ship and thinking about how, yeah, the rugged life had its points, but I don't know. And this time, one of those kind of like effeminate, fey, nature-loving dandy boys comes and asks him, you know, where can I find the embroidered lampshades? And Donald is about to direct him. And he says, you know, on second thought, I'll take you there. Darned if I ain't getting interested in embroidered lampshades myself. It's such a fascinating ending, you guys. What do you make? Warren, what do you make of the ending? What is Barks telling us?
I think Barks is stating that everyday simplicity of living is just fine. Oftentimes greed can take over if you reach for too much. And I think that's the moral of the story. I think it's a morality tale told very, very well. This story has really gone up in my collection of duck stories is one of the top for sure, based on just the whole telling of it. But the simple four-panel ending, it kind of just goes there.
Yeah, I think that's right. What do you think, Austin? What's he saying with that ending?
I agree a lot with what you said, Warren, but I almost think it might be looking a little bit too much into it. I like the message, though. No doubt Barks had something like that in mind when he was writing it. But I just always find it very nice that this story in particular, everything's come full circle, right? Everything is exactly as it was at the beginning. You could insert these four panels into the front of the story and it would have been like the same scene, right? So all that chaos went on and yet everything's back to normal. Mm-hmm. And Donald had this little taste of the high life that he wanted, but he didn't really want it as much as he thought, right? Mm-hmm. And he's back and he's looking at that same Viking ship and he's going, you know, that rugged life had its points, but I mean, I think he's saying in a way with this embroidered lampshade stuff that he's taking up an interest in, like, I'm happy with what I have. So mm-hmm. I know a bunch of people hate it when you look too deep into Barks, but I guess like what's nice is that there is a simple message here and it's just be happy with what you have because you wish for too much and it's never what you think it is. And your life is probably a lot cooler than you think it may be.
That's really well put, Austin.
I'm wondering, is this a repudiation of like uber masculinity? Is he saying like it's not all it's cracked up to be?
I think so. The myth and the legend of masculinity isn't all that great.
I mean, I guess in this masculinity and ruggedness are not like exact synonyms, and maybe I should be talking about ruggedness. I don't know. I can't help but think about where the country is in this time, right? We've just like, it hasn't been that long since World War II ended, which was like this really upsetting. Yeah. I think there must have been this kind of like almost crisis of masculinity after the war and all that loss. But I don't know. I'm not wholly sure what to make of it because like this is a very gentle, this is kind of like an endorsement of gentility at the end, right? Like, and it's, if you think about like Donald Duck's worst nightmare, where Donald just had this like freak out that he could be associated with tatting, say, and now he's like, eagerly going off to learn about embroidered lampshades. It's a really interesting closer to me. But yeah. but I think you guys have great points about kind of that like emphasis on the simple life. And it is okay to just be a very good museum guard. So you guys, we did it. We've talked about this legendary story. At least we've talked about the action of it. I feel like we could go on and on about this, but I want to kind of limit ourselves to, you know, what are your overall closing thoughts about the story? Austin, you want to start off?
Sure. I didn't think a ton of it on first read, which was a couple months ago. Like I said, it was after a bunch of other Bark stories, dozens of the adventures and a couple hundred of the 10 pagers. So, I mean, I'd consumed so much of the genius at that point. But I mean, certainly after discussing it tonight, like you said, Warren, it would probably be higher on my personal favorites list also. You know, it's less is more because the drawing style is so simple yet so detailed. Barks was counting the syllables on each page. I mean, this last page alone is easily 50, 60 words, maybe even less than that. I think it's a great story from any angle and a really meaningful one. I think we had some nice discussion with the ending and its overall meaning also.
Excellent. Well, what do you think, Warren? How does this one leave you?
I think there are moments of humor, which we want in a Bark story, but humor doesn't dominate. I think there's all these wonderful undertones of mythology, of ancient history, all these wonderful glimpses of incredible artwork. But for me, it was this trading off of power and greed that whether you look at the helmet as with mysterious powers or just the symbol of whoever holds it becomes powerful, at least in their mind, to me is one of the biggest morality tales that he's told. And so for me, that exchange, and I'll kind of go back to breaking the story up into the parts, this last third of the story was so critical to tell. And it, to me, it just got me thinking about how perhaps we all live our lives and finding that, again, the last four panels, there's nothing wrong with just the simple life.
Thanks for that. I love this story. This is an all-time favorite. This is certainly a top five story for me. In the case of like the index ranking, you know, we're not covering that because I already mentioned it's like number three. I think that's pretty much right on the money. This is a top five, top 10. It is such a wildly inventive adventure story. And that's kind of what I come to. It's got some great themes. Don't get me wrong. I love the themes. I love the idea of the corruption. I love the kind of the masculinity, that like vein of what is it to be a man in 1952 in this like weird time in history. All of that stuff is great, but like the bones of it is this incredible race for a token, right? A MacGuffin, an artifact. And we've got this great, like, a mystery where we don't even expect there to be a mystery. It is an incredible treasure hunt with not a trace of Scrooge McDuck in sight. It is just filled to the brim with some of Bark's absolute best art. You know, he was doing exactly what he wanted to do. Apart from like Donald Duck in Old California, I don't think there's a time that he's felt like better about what he's drawing when he's done a duck story than this one. We have these wildly inventive turns of phrases and this just bonkers lawyer character, this amazing like snakish the villain I love to hate more than almost any other. I could wax on and on about what a great old-fashioned rip-roaring story The Golden Helmet is. I can't say enough kind things about it. I think it's one of his utter masterpieces. You cannot go wrong if you want to introduce someone to Carl Barks. Give him this story, right? I mean, the only way it could go wrong is because they might expect all of them to live up to the greatness of this. But
well put, Mark. Yeah, and you mentioned about Scrooge McDuck not even appearing in here or being mentioned, and wow, the growth of Donald and the execution of the storytelling, this rip-roaring yarn. It had a lot of that adventure that I discovered when I first watched Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was a movie when I saw in 1979 when it came out. I was just over 20 years old, and it blew me away.
Yeah, I just want to throw it in before we wrap it up. You know, before we recorded, I look at Index, and it's greatest Donald marquee story of all time. I mean, what are you talking about? I guess from an objective point of view, it honestly might be. It's got so much depth to it, so many overlapping plots. I mean, there's a lot to like about it. There really is.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't begrudge anyone. If you don't think it's the greatest of all time, that's fine. I'm not even sure I'd call it the best Donald Duck adventure, but it's way up there. It's got to be in the conversation. So, you guys, just a few more reflections before we wind things down. You know, as befitting one of the greatest stories that Barks ever did, he of course did a pretty awesome oil painting for this one, right? It of course has to adapt that great panel. Did you guys come across, I guess he started another oil painting that was Donald sighting the star. He only got up to doing a sketch for it, but that could have been pretty cool too.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite drawings in the star. I'm looking at it right now, and Mark, I was not aware that Barks started that as an oil, but no, it that little panel, it became the cover, which became the oil painting, is probably one of the finest depictions of Donald Duck and the nephews. I still think Sheriff of Bullet Valley is the best cover, but that's just me.
Oh, it's great.
This one's up there in my top five covers, I will say that right now.
So you guys, I'm going to talk about some sequels, kind of mull over. The last thing to do is just favorite panels, of course, which I know is a big order. So there have been a couple of sequels. Don Rosa did a really cool follow-up called The Lost Charts of Columbus. I really like that one as far as his sequels go. It kind of evokes Guardians of the Lost Library to me, which is like one of my all-time favorites. So I think that's a very successful sequel. I know that for some people, your mileage may vary with Rosa, but I love that one. There's another one by a famous Italian. Austin, you're more versed in the Italian duck artists than I am. Do you know Massimo De Vita, the story?
I don't know if I know the story.
Yeah, so it's a Mickey Mouse story, actually. It's Topolino e l'Imperatore d'America, Mickey Mouse and the Emperor of America. But I think it must be a Mickey and Donald story. I would be really interested to read that. I know that a lot of people really like him, and I don't think I've read a single one of his.
Wow. Yeah, he does great stuff. We don't have that one in America yet, though. So Dave Gerstein, Fantagraphics, if you're listening.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Good one to localize.
Sure. I guess it is worth mentioning on the topic of Italian stories and sort of sequels. Romano Scarpa did a story called Zio Paperon e il Casco d'Oro, which is Uncle Scrooge and the Golden Helmet. It has no relation to this story, but when you directly translate it, it's the exact same title. So when we got that in America, they changed it to Captured in Banana Land, which is a great story. So you guys should check that one out. But
nice. Yeah, I'll make a point of it. There was also an Italian prequel just a couple of years ago that kind of tied, I guess it tied Golden Helmet in with Land of the Pygmy Indians a little bit. It actually featured Olaf the Blue in his day encountering the Pee-wee gods. So another one that I'll have to check out.
Not aware of those. That's great. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Reflections on how this holds up. I think there are certain elements where it's kind of got a time capsule-ish quality, but on the whole, I think this one just holds up incredibly well. Doesn't feel modern, but it does feel timeless to me.
I mean, it's certainly a timeless plot at its core. You know, who's going to be the leader of North America? That's definitely something we can still connect with 70 years later.
And those stakes, just the stakes. And you know, I didn't dwell on the fact it is weird that it's just North America and not South America when they are connected, but that's not what Barks wanted to do. And of course, you know, it of course ignores the people that were already there, but again, not the story he's looking to tell. I did find this a very educational one. I learned about what a sextant was from this. I learned about puffins and the word cairn. This one really fired my imagination in a way that I feel like it in informed me about kind of Vikings and the north, the northern oceans.
The one thing that I learned was the term headland. I had not heard of that. Yeah. So I went and Googled it and I read all about the headland of continents and offshore and the rocky, you know, structures that were there. I mean, he uses these incredibly accurate terms to build on the lore.
Oh, I learned so many little geographical terms from reading Bark's stories. As far as I know, neither of the DuckTales series ever adapted or featured this. Well, you guys, the last thing to cover, unless someone has another thought, this is a hard thing. Favorite panel. This is just crawling with amazing panels. So Warren, what do you got?
Well, I have four favorite panels, and I'll just quickly go over them. Mm-hmm. The first panel of the story is one of my favorite panels because it sets it up. It shows the board guard with the background of the Viking ship in the museum, and there's humor in it, there's anticipation, and there's Donald as we know Donald. It's the largest panel in the whole story. I like the when he comes home and meets the nephews and gets them wanting to go to Labrador. When they say, "What is that, a movie?" He just slams his head into the wall. I mean, how many times do you feel like doing that? And he did it. I love that. And the other two panels are on the same page. It's where he's positioning at the sextant. I love that angle of where he's actually showing where how to find the North Star or whatever he's doing there. And then, of course, the bottom panel that we talked about it a lot. And that is my favorite of dark and light and color and ruggedness. And it's just wonderful. So those are my four panels.
Those are all excellent choices. I would be happy to echo any of those. What about you, Austin?
Okay, so I'm going to cheat a little and say that I think all the panels are awesome and I want to pick one. So I just want to give another shout out to the cover, which I just think is so wonderfully rendered and just so awesome and appealing. Just to me, it's such a nicely drawn image. I've had it at my side for the entire 2 hours and I've just been doing nothing but staring at it. If you see me looking off to the right of my it's so awesome, the cover.
I think that's very fair. Like, of all the stories, this is a good one to say they're all great, because they are. I really do echo all of those excellent choices, Warren. I'd love to kind of highlight a couple of quieter ones. Like him rapping on the peg is really great as he finds the deerskin. There's an amazing perspective on the second page of the Viking ship at kind of an angle that is just a wonderful shot. Yeah. Anytime someone is holding up the Viking, the golden helmet, especially Donald with the helmet in one hand and the parchment in the other, proclaiming he'll be King Donald, the Viking kid. Anytime someone gets a gleam in their eye, Donald's sighting, it really is a great, obviously that amazing panel where they find the helmet. The ickiest view of America is such a good panel. I've looked at that for longer than I care to admit. And just the cairn of rocks with that scowling puffin, I love too. I'm sorry, you guys. I could go on and on. I'll save it for Facebook. Just the last one, I guess, is the nephews hugging onto that mast, chilled to the bone with icy seawater, while Donald is, doggedly sailing on. What a great piece of art and characterization and dialogue this story is. All right. Thank you guys for indulging me. Thank you for all your time. This has been a pretty extended episode. I really appreciate it. This was an awesome conversation. Like, big thanks to you. I think we had a great discussion about this one. Any closers? Any final thoughts here?
It's a great story. So, I mean, I don't know. If you haven't read it and you're listening to this, I don't know what you're doing. Go find a copy.
I'm going to echo Austin and Mark and say that if you haven't really read and looked at and admired a Bark's story, I don't care if it's a 10-pager or a 32-pager, you've got to experience it. This is the one to launch you into that addiction to the Duckman. Again, I'll say it one last time, often from the depths of despair as Bark's was experiencing come great work. This really, at the age of 50, he was halfway through his life, and there were a lot more excellent things to come.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you guys, thank you again. We did it. I'm so thrilled. I invite listeners to come back next week when I get to feature the great story, The Gilded Man. Please reach out on the Facebook page, Barks Remarks Facebook page. We've got an Insta now. I'm on Instagram as well. Barks Remarks on Instagram and Twitter. And thank you guys again. Don't go getting any gleams in your eyes.